And welcome back. You're tuned to WBAI Radio in New York City, 99.5 FM on your radio dial and on the web at WBAI.org. I'm Kathy Davis, and I am here filling in for Hugh Hamilton, who is going to be out for a couple of days. And in the first segment, we shared with you some of the work of our Dr. Michio Kaku from his program Exploration, which you can hear, by the way, every Saturday. I think it is at 2 o'clock on Saturdays, but you can check that out on our website at WBAI.org. There's so many events taking place, as many of you may remember, or perhaps not. This coming Sunday, April 22nd, is the celebration of Earth Day. It's an international celebration of Gaia. Teokusin says we should be calling it Mother Earth Day. It's not just Earth Day. It's about celebrating the divinity of Earth, and Earth is recognized as a female energy. And so according to the indigenous people, it's Mother Earth Day on April 22nd. And on April 21st, we have an event taking place. It's the VFP Earth Day Conference. And this is a special event. I believe the first was last year. And it's produced by Andrew Bell, our very own Andrew Bell. And myself and a number of WBAI producers will be joining this event on Saturday, April 21st, including Robert Knight will be giving a talk, and Ken Gale will be giving a talk, and you might recognize both of those names. And Andrew's going to come on in a little bit and tell us more about the whole conference that will be taking place. But today, we are really lucky that the winds of synchronicity have provided that we have in studio one of the speakers in this conference, and that's Tom Weismiller. And he has been offering a bit of an alternative view, or maybe it's a more scientific view, of global warming to really understand some questions. And Tom Weismiller has a site called colderside.com, and he speaks on the colder side of global warming. And some of the questions we could ask him are: is global warming real? Is the Arctic polar cap rapidly melting? And if the cap melts, will Florida be underwater? And many questions like this we can begin to consider, because there's a lot of fear-mongering around global changing. And I think there are some very real concerns about what the world is going to look like in another 10, 15, 50 years. Perhaps we can project some of that. So I want to say just hi to Andrew. Thank you for being with me today, Andrew.
Thank you, Kathy. Pleasure to be here.
And I want to welcome you, Tom Weismiller, very much to Talk Back. That's the name of this program this afternoon.
I'm pleased to be here, Kathy. Thank you.
Very good. So can you explain to us a little bit about your background? I know that you have been a researcher, and you have actually, you interned with NASA. You know, so you had an interesting background. Can you tell us something about how you developed yourself into, you know, the scientist that you are today?
Well, what I do today, actually I've been doing it for over 10 years, is I give lectures on the science of climate. And what I do is I take the work of many, many researchers and try to put it in a way that people can understand it and make sense of it. And mm-hmm. I keep up with it. Every presentation I've given is different. Why? Because research is coming online every day, and there are there's new data available. And one of the things I focus on is to have real data available when I try to synthesize what I have learned so that people can understand it. At NASA's Johnson Space Center, everybody who comes there brings their PowerPoint or their projections, but there's always one slide they show first, mm-hmm. and it's their slide. And it says, in God we trust, everyone else bring data. and they take it seriously. Mm-hmm. They're very very science oriented, pretty hard nosed actually, and it's quite a crew down there. Spent a lot of time there. When I joined NASA, it was before the moon landings.
Wow!
It was my dream job. Mm-hmm. I had taken a series of exams that allowed me to become a federal intern. And the interns at NASA were a little bit different in those days. The theory was, and you'll understand why I use the word theory, mm-hmm. that they would try to groom future managers in the agency. I had a meteorological background. I'd worked at the Dutch Weather Bureau. I was close to a master's in international law. NASA at that time was beginning to work with the Russians. For some reason, they liked that combination of science, math, and law, mm-hmm. and offered me a job at the agency. The management intern option was, I was one of nine interns, and what we would do, basically what they would do is they would throw us into any area that needed help, that needed a young, supposedly bright person to help them or assist them in projects. I got involved in all kinds of projects. It was like I say, my dream job. I was there before, during, and after the moon landings. Mm-hmm. Met many astronauts, scientists. My meteorological bent took me to the Tyro satellites, which were just being developed at Goddard Space Flight Center. And this is something that was brand new. In the old days, when I learned my so-called meteorological mm-hmm. training, we would take teletypes that would give you a series of data and numbers, and we would quickly take the teletypes and put them in what they call a station model. It would be a little circle, and you would put temperature on one side and wind speed in the other and, mm-hmm. and wind direction and humidity. And after you plotted all those models, you could have a sense for where fronts were, where high-pressure systems were, low-pressure systems, because mm-hmm. the barometric readings were on each of those little stations. And every day what we do is plot the entire northern hemisphere that way. So you can imagine the workload in reading all those little teletypes. Well, now all of a sudden, we had this great satellite that took a whole picture of North mm-hmm. America, of Asia, of Europe, and you could see the cloud patterns. You didn't have to look at the station models to figure out where the front was. You looked at them. You saw where the clouds were, and you could predict with some accuracy where they were going. And, mm-hmm. and this totally transformed meteorology. And NASA Goddard was the center of it. So, like I say, it was in a dream world. But they had me doing other things. One of my assignments was looking at patent notebooks. These mm-hmm. were engineering journals. They looked like the old-style composition books, mm-hmm. but the pages were pre-numbered. And every engineer, each day, at the end of the day, had to write down and make notes about what are the things they were doing. Well, why did they do that? Because NASA contractors were all over the place. NASA hired contractors, mm-hmm. other firms to do research. They would talk to the engineers. They would listen to some of the ideas. Then they quickly run out and patent them and then charge NASA a fee for using their patent.
Whoa.
Well, this is not a very good idea. Mm-hmm. So they said, if we keep records that we have the proof of the initial idea and we have documented it and witnessed it, and one of the other researchers, everybody had to double sign these books, mm-hmm. then they had the proof that the idea actually originated at NASA and nobody could, you know, charge the agency for patents. So that was a fascinating job because it got me into every single laboratory on the entire center at Goddard Space Flight Center.
Wow.
And they sent me out to San Francisco at the Ames Research Center where they had wind tunnels and mm-hmm. they had the centrifuges. And I took a ride in one of those. I don't do too well with motion sickness. Mm-hmm. But when you're spinning around at 5Gs, you get...
You get it big time, huh?
Yeah. Stomach comes out of other parts of you you don't want to know. Pretty bad.
So how did you... reach the point that you are analyzing climate change and understanding climate change?
Okay, this is really fascinating. And in this case, I give Al Gore the credit because Al Gore was involved in negotiating a treaty with the Russians where it used to be that a submarine that would transit the Arctic, go underneath the ice cap, kept all the data that they were gathering a secret. They need to know the ice depth because they'd bust their periscopes if they got too close to some of these keels in the ice that go down deep. But Al negotiated with, I think, the Russians, the French, and the British to release the ice depth data in this cut going through the Arctic. And when I saw that, I was really surprised. Number one, naively, I had thought that the ice was maybe 50, 100 feet deep. I had no idea. It turns out it was only down to about 6 feet to 8 feet deep. And I said, my goodness, this is not. What's worse, it was melting. In other words, each year the numbers would come in to be 2 inches less ice and something like that. And it doesn't take a big mathematician to figure out that this is going the wrong way. So that got me interested in it. I did a little bit of research myself and started to put things together. Realize that the polar cap is melting, and in fact it is melting, at a furious rate, but not a consistent rate. In other words, we were losing about maybe 100,000 square kilometers each year of ice during the beginning of the century. Each year, 100,000 square kilometers less. In 2007, we lost 1 million in 1 year. And this, when I'm saying lost, I mean I'm talking about the September ice coverage. We had about 40% of the Arctic Ocean open in September. And this was an incredible record. Now, back around 2001, 2002, the North Pole sometimes was already liquid in the sense that these big ice plates would move apart from each other and create what's called a lead. So that if you would sail an icebreaker up to the poles, and the Russians did that, by the way, to make money. They would charge the Westerners $5,000 each to go on an atomic-powered icebreaker. They'd take them up to the North Pole, let them walk around, say, I stood at the North Pole, collect the money, and send them back. Well, in 2000, I might be wrong on the year, it might be 2002, they got up to the pole, and it was open water. Made the front page of the New York Times. I still have that article, by the way, in my computer. And the headline said, North Pole is now liquid, scientists find. Well, wow. It's a little bit of an exaggeration because these plates kind of join back together. And in the winter, it gets so cold up there, anything's going to freeze. But then the Russians couldn't let the people walk on the ice because there wasn't any. They had to sail about 6 to 8 miles away. Then they could walk around and say, I stood near the North Pole. And it wouldn't give them a refund either. They couldn't get them back. So, obviously, there was less ice. Later on, you know, polar researchers, particularly University of Colorado, were putting together video clips taken looking down on the pole. This is satellite data. And you could see the motion of the ice, the warm water flowing in past Norway and Spitsbergen and coming around, melting the cap from underneath. Like I said, 2007, all of a sudden, 1 million extra square kilometers was vacant of ice. It was just plain water. What happens is that you have, once you have open water and wind, the combination creates what's called lake effect snow, except up there, it's ocean effect.
Okay.
Arctic Ocean. And in the polar region, winds are a little bit different. Here we have fronts come through, there are no fronts at the pole. But what you do have is the world is actually spinning underneath its own atmosphere. So the world spins from west to east. So if you're standing anywhere around the pole, let's say 80 degrees latitude, northern Greenland or the Canadian islands, the wind is always out of the east because the earth is spinning under the atmosphere and you feel wind coming out of the east. Well, the open part of the Arctic in 2007 extended from the Bering Straits, which are all the way near Alaska, all the way across, almost across the pole. So the entire Eurasian side was totally ice-free, totally. What happened that winter is you had, for the first time, hard early lake effect snow. which coated the surrounding Arctic with reflecting snow, which now when you have sunlight hitting snow, 70% gets reflected back into space and leaves the Earth. It's gone from the heat budget, so it gets colder. If you have dirt or rocks, sunlight hits the rocks. Some of it gets absorbed, some gets reflected. If it gets reflected, it's at longer wavelengths, the wavelengths that carbon dioxide trap. So you have more of that heat stays on the ground. But if it's reflected from snow, it pierces the CO2 on the way down and pierces it on the way up. Not all of it, but 70%, and only a part of the 70. But still, a lot of energy is lost to the Earth. Mm-hmm. So it got colder earlier. 2008 had the greatest snow cover extent in Eurasia ever since satellites were put in orbit.
Wow.
They put satellites in orbit. They measure the snow cover. It's easy to do because of what reflects light. And the snow lasted until mid-April through most of North America, basically reflecting lots of energy. So what happens the next winter? It got so cold that the polar cap refroze and 300,000 square kilometers of ice was added to the pole. So we didn't have 40% of the Arctic open in September in 2008. We had about 33%. But still, this warm water keeps pouring into the Arctic, keeps melting the ice from underneath. And it's not just surface area, and that's what the 40% refers to. It's also ice volume. In other words, the ice used to be 5 feet, 6 feet thick all over the pole. Not so. By the time 2007 rolls around, the average depth is about 3 feet. Mm. By the time 2011 rolled around, which was last year, last year almost touched the 2007 record. It was that close. And the same thing happened. Eurasia and Europe got pounded with snow this year. Very, very cold, again, reflecting all the incoming energy. 2012 will likely be the coldest year of the last 16.
Wow.
And we already know that. It's March, and the records in Asia and in Europe have been broken on the downside so much that there's a foregone conclusion that it's going to be cold. Now, that's the world temperature. Here in North America, we got very lucky. We had the effect of La Niña.
Mm-hmm.
La Niña is when the Pacific cools. Actually, the sea surface in the equatorial Pacific is colder. El Niño, which you've probably heard of too, is when you have a warm equatorial Pacific. Now, what's the difference? Why would one be warmer, one not be warmer? The difference really turns out to be clouds, cloud cover and evaporation. If you evaporate water from a surface, the evaporation absorbs heat from the surface. It's like when a dentist takes a little air gun and tries to dry out a tooth after they've drilled a cavity. Well, the tooth feels real cold because the water is evaporating and sucking in energy from anywhere it can get it. Oh. Well, in your mouth, it's a tooth. On the ocean, it turns out that it's the sea surface. So the sea surface cools. There's also ocean currents that are responsible too. Clouds form. When clouds form, they take that water vapor and transport it, usually over land somewhere. When the rain falls out of the cloud, that same heat or energy, and it's not just heat, it's also kinetic energy, that was used to evaporate the water happens to then get released in the air, usually over land, warming the land. Mm-hmm. So you have a two-edged sword here. You have the ocean surface cooling and land surfaces where these clouds go warming. When the ocean surface is cooler, there's less contrast between the poles and the equator, less temperature contrast, which means you tend to have less air circulation going between the two. When that happens, the jet stream flattens out. The jet stream are these high-speed air currents. There's two of them in the northern hemisphere, northern jet, southern jet. They normally undulate like a wave, if you've seen what a sine wave looks like. And when they dip down, they bring down cold air from the poles. When they go up, they bring up warm air from the equator. If you have a high temperature contrast, that's going to increase. Well, when you have a low contrast, like we had with La Nina, it doesn't work that way. The jet stream goes flat across North America. We get storms here that you call Alberta Clippers. And I think I mentioned these in Ken Gale's broadcast when I did my climate forecast last December. Mm-hmm. Because these Alberta Clippers tend to be dry, not a lot of snow in them. And we had a couple of them this winter, you know, two inches of snow, something like that. Mm-hmm. But the thing, if we had an undulating jet stream bringing up Gulf moisture falling into colder air in the winter, mm-hmm. we get snow that we can measure here by the foot. Mm. We didn't have that. We had that 2 years ago because then we had an El Nino situation, high temperature contrast, lots of undulation in these weather systems. Mm. So this year we were spared. North America was spared. A very, very snow-free North America. I thought, excuse me, that La Nina would break up beginning of March. I think it broke up at the end of March. I was off by a week or two. So we didn't get any snow, really, of consequence. But finally, in March, early April, we got this big blob of warm air coming up mm-hmm. from the Gulf. The West had a lot of cold air coming down from the Alaska regions, and then you had the classic undulation of the jet stream. Now, Anchorage, Alaska, had more snow this winter than any winter in its history. Why? Because the cold air stayed up there. When the jet stream flattens out, the cold air stays near the pole, the warm air stays near the equator, and not a lot of mixing. Mm. So, go ahead.
Well, this all is beginning to make me realize how complex our ecosystem is. You know, and in terms of all of the water and the wind and the oceans and the, so it's complex. And so when we throw in the concept of climate change and global warming, it's hard for me to determine what you're speaking of is a natural trend and what you're speaking of may not be a natural trend in terms of the shrinking of the ice, in terms of the changing in the temperatures. So I'm wondering if we have about, I think, maybe another 20 minutes. Is that right, Michael? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what I'd like for you to do is to throw, you know, all of this global warming, climate change, we're heading to a new ice age or whatever it is, you know, how people have these fears of what's happening. If you can explain what's really happening.
I could try, and you're absolutely right about the complexity.
Okay, and before we go on, I just wanted to let people know you're listening to WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. Go ahead.
One of the things I make everybody angry. People who say global warming is not real, I say, sorry, it is. In fact, I have real hard evidence, and Ren, this is data-oriented. The sea surface temperatures are getting warmer. On my webpage, I have one page where it shows the Atlantic and Pacific and Northern and Southern Hemisphere sea surface temperatures, and there is a gradual upward trend. And the oceans are the greatest heat sink on the planet. The atmosphere isn't. The atmosphere does retain some heat, but the oceans much, much more. And sunlight hitting the sea surface usually goes straight into the oceans. It doesn't reflect off. At angles, it does. If it hits snow, of course, it does. And if it hits clouds, it reflects off. But the oceans are a pretty good absorber of heat, but they're also very deep. Most mm-hmm. of the ocean's heat is retained in the top 100 feet or so. We can measure that heat. We have buoys all over the world measuring sea surface temperatures. So the oceans are getting warmer. In fact, what they're doing is they're melting the polar cap. The warming seas moving into the Arctic Ocean are melting that floating polar cap. Now, when the floating polar cap melts, sea level does not change. Why? Because the cap is floating. It's like a glass with an ice cube in it. When the ice cube melts, the water doesn't spill out of the glass. The ice, the floating ice, actually is displacing all the water that it will displace when it melts. So there's no change whatsoever in sea level rise from the floating polar cap. Land ice melting, though, different story. When land ice melts, it either enters rivers, which eventually get into the oceans, or enters the aquifer, which stays underground for a while until either we use it or it goes out to the oceans, or it evaporates. But it does, it can raise sea levels if it melts. The edges of Greenland, for instance, are melting. They're melting at an accelerating rate. However, the interior of Greenland is accreting snow. Right now, it's kind of in balance. One year, they'll lose more volume of ice, and another, the next year, they gain it. Actually, the more open the Arctic is, the greater the ocean effect snow coming on the eastern side of Greenland and the buildup of snow on the center of Greenland versus the edges. Mm-hmm. So there's a real balance there. Antarctica is a different story. Antarctica is surrounded by a donut of pack ice, which expands in the winter. Pack ice is frozen seawater. Now, seawater will freeze. Some of it kind of freshens and leaches out some of the salt, but it's like a briny mix. You wouldn't want to take it in your mouth and eat it because there's still some retained salt. But what it does is it stops moisture from escaping from the ocean itself. So storms surrounding the Antarctic usually dump their snow on the pack ice and rarely reach the interior of Antarctica. So Antarctica has been called the driest place on Earth. It's very dry. Some places it only snows a quarter of an inch a year, that kind of thing. But it's so cold, 130 below zero, 70 below zero when it gets warm, that the ice and snow really don't melt too much. Mm-hmm. But this warming oceans are beginning to melt that pack ice donut, so that now the storms get closer to the continent and leave some of the snow on the continent, and Antarctica is starting to gain snow in years where the pack ice donut is smaller. Now, if it gets real cold, the pack ice donut expands. It's not consistent. It's like an ebb and flow. And you can do a fairly good job predicting the amount of snowfall on Antarctica by looking from a satellite data and seeing how big that pack ice donut is. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, we had a fairly small donut and lots of ice and snow getting deposited on Antarctica. Last year, we didn't have too much because that donut actually got bigger. That varies. Now, let me answer some of your other questions. Mm-hmm. One of the things you mentioned was how much are people responsible for this? My personal view is that there is some acceleration of this warming due to people. How much? I don't know. I don't have the data to look at it. I know CO2 is being produced not only outgassed by the oceans, but we are outgassing it ourselves from coal-fired plants and other things. But CO2 reacts a little bit differently when you start having lots of snow cover. And that's one of the things that I'm a little concerned about, because the opening of the Arctic is creating more of that snow cover. And when you have lots of that reflectivity, the impact of CO2 over that snow is less than the impact of CO2 over open country or over open ocean in other places. Why? Because the wavelengths of light that CO2 likes to trap aren't all in that reflected sunlight. Sunlight coming in punches through the CO2 on the way down and can punch through on the way up at the wavelengths that CO2 does not like to intercept. Water vapor intercepts a different set. So the more snow cover you have, you're actually decreasing the effect of CO2 in that region of the planet. Now, we had
And that's carbon, too?
Carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not carbon. Now, there's a difference. And carbon itself also is spewed out in large amounts when you burn coal or burn oil. But that comes out as particulate carbon. These are soot particles. Get a lot of them in your lungs, and you're not going to be too happy, and some of them don't react too well with you. There are also things that we should be paying much more attention to. Poisons entering our rivers, our aquifers. And by focusing on CO2, I think we are missing some of the more egregious targets that we should be focusing on. Now, why am I saying we're maybe over-focusing on CO2? For the last 15 years, because of the increasing albedo, reflectivity on the planet, temperatures have flatlined. Worldwide temperatures are all within 0.2 of a degree centigrade flat. Flat mm-hmm. as a pancake. CO2 is still going up. CO2 continues increasing. My view is, again, the oceans, the warming oceans, are more responsible than anything else. Plant biota also has an effect. Humans have an effect of adding CO2. But the link between that warming and CO2 for at least a while seems to have stopped dead. If you look at the last 10,000 years of temperatures, we have bounced around within a 2-degree centigrade zone. It's about maybe 5 degrees or 6 degrees Fahrenheit. For 10,000 years, CO2, by the way, also flatlined and bounced around for 10,000 years. And then in the last 200 years, whoosh, up 40% more CO2 in the atmosphere now today than there was 200 years ago. 40%, that's a huge amount. And yet temperatures have gone up in that interval and now are flatlining because of the increase of reflectivity. And I think the reflectivity is beginning to overtake the effect of CO2. So what should EPA do? I think, hey, hold off on CO2 for a while and start getting those poisons out of our environment quickly, because they do have a terrible effect on humans. Mm-hmm. If temperatures start moving up again, and by the way, the more open Arctic you have, the less chance that is of happening. But if they do, then you can focus on CO2 again. But right now, I think we've done a lot in CO2. People are conscious of it. There's a difference between carbon management from a resource management standpoint and carbon management from a climate standpoint. And my great fear for the environmental movement is that if the link between CO2 and temperature stays disconnected the way it is now, the average person in the world is going to say, see, there's no problem with carbon at all. The people who were scaremongering us were wrong, and the attention on the poisons will get totally diverted and discredited. Mm-hmm. If an environmentalist is discredited, it's a terrible uphill fight for them to try to get other horrible things out of the environment. And I don't want to see them discredited because of their focus on CO2. It's a terrible mistake.
Okay. Well, this is a fascinating conversation that we're not going to be able to finish today because we just have about 10 minutes more to go. But I wanted Andrew to give people a chance to let them people know where they can come and hear you talk even more, and then we'll get back to your talk about CO2. So, Andrew, tell us about this event, the peace event that's taking place on Saturday.
Yes. Thank you very much, Kathy. And thank you very much to BAI for existing for 51 years to provide this platform. I have the pleasure of serving Volunteers for Peace. That's VFP.org as a board member going into my third year. And this is the second event that we've had in the city of New York, open to all of Metro New York. Participants coming from Westport, New Jersey, Staten Island, Long Island, and one from Pennsylvania, and one from D.C. too. This year, as it is Earth Day this weekend, we're focusing on Mother Earth. We want to connect. We want everyone to be aware of what's happening around them. Climate, activism, and grassroots organizations. So Tom is representative of the caliber program we have attained this year. Tom is our keynote speaker. The program begins at 2 p.m. in Ossining at 116 Hawks Avenue. If you would like more details, you can contact me, Andrew Bell, at wbai.org. That's Andrew Bell at wbai.org. And also, the program announcement is on the WBAI.org homepage. If you scroll down about 3/4 of the way, you'll see the VFP.org Peace Action Conference announced. The Rivertown Kids will be performing, as well as the Raging Grannies of Westchester. It's going to be a fun day.
That's right. It'll feature some of our producers here from WBAI, including Ken Gale and Robert Knight, who will be on in just a few minutes hosting the 5 o'clock shadow. So I want to get back to you. I just wanted to make sure people had an opportunity to find out what they can participate in. So tell us a little bit more about what's happening with the environment. So because of all of the, you know, car emissions and pollution emissions and all of this pollution that's going into the air, do you consider that to be like the particulate stuff or this, what do you call it, the CO2 stuff?
Well, again, CO2 is part of it, but I'm, you know, very concerned about it. I landed in New York this morning from the West Coast, from Oregon, and I flew in over New York City. Dawn had just broken, and you could see this thick haze already. And this is April over New York City.
But that might be chemtrails.
It was what I would call smog.
Smog.
Right. And it was uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And coming down, the person sitting next to me says, my goodness, we had to breathe that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, yep. Because, we left in Oregon, and it happened to be quite clean. So we do have a big problem, I think, with things that we're putting into the air.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good. By the way, your listeners should know that I'm also the guy that does the annual winter forecast here on WBAI.
Mm-hmm.
And that winter forecast is archived on my website.
Okay.
So if you go to colderside.com in the FAQ section, 4 or 5 questions down, you'll see a link to the WBAI winter forecast. I've got 2 or 3 of them on there. I do come on early December every winter and let you guys know at least what I think is going to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
The show is Ecologic. It's hosted by Ken Gale on WBAI.
Mm-hmm. And now it's on, I believe, alternate Tuesdays at 8, I believe. 8 p.m. is where it is now.
Yeah.
So give out that website again.
It's colderside.com. And there are a couple of links in the top. You get a short little video clip about what's happening in Antarctica, as far as sea levels are concerned. And also the disconnect between CO2 and temperature, at least the short-term disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And the data is there. It's the information that you can use to make decisions. This is not guessing. This is just hard temperature data. The temperature data I use is the Hadley Climate Research Unit from the University of East Anglia in Britain, highly respected. Their data is good, and it's up there, and you can see it for yourself.
Very interesting. So it seems to me that what you're saying is that the human population and human industry is adding enormous poisons into our atmosphere and into our waters and making it difficult to...
I don't want it to become enormous, all right? They're not enormous yet.
They're not enormous yet, okay.
But they are measurable and identifiable, and we can stop the factories and the people from doing things to make them worse. You want to make sure that the world stays clean.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it's not as clean as it was 100 years ago because of the things we've put into our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think we need to focus on that. It's very important. CO2, if you want to use it as a resource conservation measure, it makes eminent sense. But my fear is that governments are jumping on a tax bandwagon and looking just for the revenue and not looking at the consequences of capturing that revenue.
Mm-hmm.
If it conserves resources, it's a good thing. If it pretends, and that's my word, to focus on climate, I think people are being misled because there is a disconnect and it's pretty obvious.
Well, this is interesting because you're really speaking counter to what a lot of the general I won't say consensus, but the general information that I hear puts that a very, very close link of climate change and global warming to this carbon output.
I know.
And you're saying that there are two separate things happening. There's all of these variations in our temperatures and weather, which may be part of a larger cycle for all we know,
well,
right?
They're part of our general
just like a natural
system.
Yeah. And so people are sort of pushing them together, and you're saying they don't necessarily, one is not necessarily entirely the consequence of the other.
Not always. And some of the programs that I've heard are, in my view, counterintuitive. For instance, a cap-and-trade program curtails, in other words, utilities would have to buy credits to be allowed to continue polluting. And they buy the credits from other industries or places on Earth where they guarantee they will not be. For instance, in the Amazon forest, they promise not to cut certain acreages of trees. And in exchange for that, and buying those credits, the governments involved take some tax revenue off it, and the utilities then continue business as usual.
That sounds very insane to me.
I'm not happy about it.
Okay, well, this is an interesting discussion, and I think it's something that we could go into very deeply. I can see how you would make people get angry because you're sort of taking the easy sell of the global warming problem to sort of fix industry, and you're making it very much more complex.
Everybody can throw a snowball at me, mm-hmm. you know? The people who deny climate is changing, they're not happy with me. The people who think we have a runaway greenhouse, they're not happy with me either. Mm-hmm. The increased albedo is almost guaranteed to make sure that we don't have a runaway greenhouse.
Okay.
So that's the good news, all right? So there's, you know.
Well, it's interesting and it's complex, and I have a lot more respect for meteorologists now. I look at the guys on TV and I'm like, yeah, right, you're just looking at a computer. But I have a sense that you have like a very deep understanding.
Thank you.
Of these things, and I very much appreciate that. I have a lot more respect for your work, you know, knowing you now. So
thanks.
Thank you so much. Again, give your website because we're out of time, unfortunately.
Okay, it's colderside.com, and you can even email me, and I get about 600 emails a day.
Mm-hmm.
I try to triage them. I try to answer the ones that aren't spam. And thank
That's
you.
That's excellent. And remember that you can find out more about the Volunteers for Peace Earth Day Conference. It's Saturday, April 21st, starting at 2 p.m. And you can go to our website, wbai.org, to find out more about it. And I also want to invite you to tune in on Sunday, April 22nd. We're doing a special Earth Day broadcast from 11 a.m. till 6 p.m. And we're going to be broadcasting some highlights from this event also on that day. And I also join me tomorrow here at 3 o'clock again. I'll be filling in for Hugh Hamilton, and we'll be talking about what Indigenous peoples are saying about our relationship with the Earth. So I thank you, Michael G., for engineering, and thank you very much, Andrew. And I especially want to thank our guest today. Thank you so much for coming in. Kind of at the last minute. It's pretty special. Tom Weissmuller, thank you for coming.
You're very welcome. I'll see you all on Saturday.
Excellent.